Welcome to another edition of the Health First Show. I'm your host, Dave Fuller. We're going to be talking about medical screening today, and we're going to be talking with Alan Castle about his book, Seeking Sickness. And in the second half of the show, we're going to be talking about a two-day superfood cleanse where actually you can eat dark chocolate. But before we do that, here's Reg with the health news.
Poor sleep is tied to a higher risk of mental decline in older men, according to a new study. It included more than 2,800 men, average age 76, in six locations across the U.S. Sleep data was collected from the men through a wrist device for an average of 5 nights, and participants underwent tests to assess their attention and executive function. Researchers found higher levels of poor sleep quality were associated with a 40% to 50% increased risk of significant decrease in executive function, similar in degree to the effect of a 5-year increase in age. Length of sleep did not affect the men's mental skills, according to the study published in the April issue of Sleep. Drinking coffee may reduce the risk of death from certain types of liver cirrhosis, a large new study suggests. The study included more than 63,000 Chinese people aged 45 to 74 living in Singapore. Starting in 1993, they provided information about their diet, lifestyle habits, and medical history, and were followed for an average of nearly 15 years. During that time, 114 of the study participants died from liver cirrhosis. Drinking 2 or more cups of coffee a day was associated with a 66% lower risk of death from liver cirrhosis caused by non-viral hepatitis. According to the study published online recently in the journal Hepatology, drinking 2 or more cups of coffee a day was associated with a 66% lower risk of death from liver cirrhosis caused by non-viral hepatitis. Buying so-called life experiences makes Americans happier than material goods such as cars, but according to a new study, they tend to favor the latter in the mistaken belief they provide better value. Part of the reason for this is that life experiences offer only memories, while people know the actual value of their material goods, says study co-author Ryan Howell, who has done extensive research on spending and happiness. Researchers interviewed people before and after they made purchases and found consumers felt life experiences like a weekend trip made them happier and were a better use of money than material items. The study was published online recently in the Journal of Positive Psychology. And finally, we know fresh produce is good for your health, but now a large study suggests eating plenty of fruits and vegetables may substantially cut your risk of death. Researchers analyzed the eating habits of more than 65,000 people in England between 2001 and 2013. They found those who ate 7 or more portions of fresh fruits and vegetables a day had a 42% lower risk of death at any age than those who ate less than 1 portion a day. The risk of death was reduced by 36% with 5 to 7 portions, 29% with 3 to 5 portions, and 14% with 1 to 3 portions, according to the findings in the Journal of Epidemiology and Community Health. But the study didn't prove eating a lot of fruits and vegetables can cut your risk of death. It only found an association between fresh produce consumption and lower death risk.
Well, our first guest is Alan Castle, who is a drug policy researcher affiliated with the School of Health Information Sciences at the University of Victoria. He's co-authored a book called Selling Sickness, about the role the pharmaceutical industry has in helping to create and maintain illness. Alan, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Tell us a little bit about the background on why you thought this was necessary.
Well, I've been studying sort of the behavior of the pharmaceutical industry for about 20 years. That book that you're talking about, Selling Sickness, we published it in 2005. I wrote it with an Australian journalist, a guy named Ray Moynihan. And Moynihan and I both came to the same conclusion from different directions. He's Australian, I'm Canadian. We determined that the pharmaceutical industry is very successful at creating illness, and they do this as a precursor to sell drugs for just about everything. And so in this book we documented, you know, more than 10 examples of diseases that we consider to be largely created, developed by, and promoted by the pharmaceutical industry. And, you know, at the end of the day, most people would say, that's absurd. How could the drug industry create illness? Well, when you look at how they have been able to define diseases in a way that the solution is a drug, you'll realize how clever they are and how duped many of the rest of us are.
You know, let's talk about some of those diseases. What are the ones that really seem to be fabricated in terms of calling them diseases?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think one thing I should stipulate is that everything has some truth at the core. Mm-hmm. So even something like, we'll say something like attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. So this is a condition that affects largely boys, children in elementary and middle schools. Kids are disruptive in class. They have difficulty sitting down and paying attention. And, that characterizes a lot of us. In fact, I was probably like that when I was growing up as well. Though it was never seen as a disease. It was seen as, this kid is just rambunctious and hyperactive, lots of energy. Today, you've got the situation where teachers are trying to handle 25 or 30 kids in a classroom, and you've got a couple of disruptive kids, and they end up saying to the parents, you've got to do something. And that something typically is taking the kid to the doctor and put on a stimulant. Mm-hmm. So the kid gets a label of a disease, gets a drug, when in fact, really, now, at the very extreme end, let me maintain that there are some children that will be helped by that, and it's a good thing that we have some treatments. But the vast majority of people who get thus labeled and fed stimulants, you're treating essentially a social condition, not a medical condition. But the growth in attention deficit disorder drugs, say even in the last 10 years, has been spectacular. The rise has been out of this world. And you might say, well, what's going on here? Are we really that much more hyperactive in classrooms than we were 10 years ago? And I would say what has changed is that the condition increasingly is seen as a medical condition that requires drugs. And the industry has been behind researching and promoting that viewpoint.
What is the long-term effect of those drugs on these children?
Well, see, that's the thing, is that these drugs are tested in 6 months or a year or maybe even a year and a half or 2 year studies, but we have no idea what the longer-term effects on the developing brain of a child is. That's why you would say, well, before we would even jump to any kind of pharmacotherapy for kids, that you would make sure that you had proper evidence, proper study. There isn't that study. And there isn't any proof otherwise that kids who do take these drugs do better than kids who don't. So the industry is very good at promoting this idea that, oh yes, you want your kids to finish school. There's a higher success rate of graduating from high school if you take these drugs versus not taking them. That has not been proven. That's simply false. And so you even get sort of these kind of exaggerated statistics saying kids do better on these when they don't.
What are some of the other diseases that that you wrote about?
Yeah, so, I mean, there's some really extreme examples. I think the one that, there's mental conditions such as social anxiety disorder, mm-hmm. or treatments for female sexual dysfunction, mm-hmm. or, even things like high cholesterol. And in fact, I think that probably in my book, the most compelling example of the selling of sickness is around cholesterol.
Let's talk about that, because that's a multi-million or billion-dollar industry, just cholesterol itself.
Absolutely. In fact, Lipitor, which was the world's top-selling drug for a number of years, a couple years ago, Pfizer was selling $12 billion a year worth of Lipitor.
Wow.
Probably more than $1.5 billion just in Canada, probably more than 80 to 100 billion here, or sorry, 100 million here in British Columbia. Anybody between the ages of, say, 50 to 75 will routinely visit their doctor. Their doctor will order a cholesterol test. And based on the definition of what is considered to be high, and I can't tell you what that is because it keeps changing, but a certain percentage of the people, by the very definition, are going to be defined as at risk and put on cholesterol-lowering drugs. And so you might say, well, what's wrong with that? Because the high cholesterol is a precursor for heart attacks and strokes. If we can reduce... high cholesterol. If we can reduce high cholesterol, then we can reduce the number of heart attacks and strokes. Great idea if that actually worked in practice. But what we see from the published evidence is that the vast majority of people who have mild to moderately elevated high cholesterol will not benefit from those drugs. They'll spend a lot of money, they'll take the drugs, and the differences in terms of, and the drugs will lower their cholesterol, but that doesn't really matter. What matters is whether you lower your risk of a heart attack or stroke. And for the average at-risk person, there is no benefit in terms of how much longer you're going to live or your reduced risk of having a heart attack or stroke by taking cholesterol-lowering drugs.
Is there any risk of other side effects that are perhaps more serious than the cholesterol by itself?
See, this is a very, very controversial area, and I've written a number of papers about this and looked at this very closely, is that the number of people that have... So the cholesterol can really, I mean, I don't want to get too technical, but it can really play havoc with your with certain systems in your body. And one of the things that it can affect quite strongly is your muscles. And so a lot of people report having serious muscle weakening, or they have trouble getting out of bed, or they feel achy and sore all the time. That's a direct side effect of cholesterol-lowering drugs. And probably 20 to 25% of the people who take them will experience those kind of side effects. And, I mean, this is cruel and ironic, but the one thing you need to do if you've got a risk of heart disease is to exercise more. And if you're getting muscle aches and pains because you're taking cholesterol-lowering drug, guess what you're going to be doing less of?
Yeah.
And so the drugs can actually prevent you from doing the one thing you need to do.
You know, when I think about scare tactics in the media, I don't know if they're scare tactics, but, you know, I think about the flu vaccine.
Yeah.
What you've done some research on this. What did you discover?
Well, you know, again, this is a very controversial area. And first of all, I don't have any problem with general childhood vaccines or, you know, vaccinating kids for illnesses that once used to be fairly fatal and serious. At the same time, the flu, I mean, we're talking average healthy people being told to every year get your flu shot. Well, you know, when you look at the study of that body of research around the flu, you find that very few benefits. In fact, it's somewhere between 1 and 3% of people, healthy people, being given a flu shot might be saved from developing the flu.
1 to 3%.
Yeah, so what that translates into is that you've got to prevent one event. When I say an event, I mean, say, a case of the flu, you have to vaccinate somewhere between 30 and 100 people.
Sounds like a lot of money.
It's a lot of money, and for very low impact. And we're talking about the flu here.
Hmm.
Now, you might say, well, you know, people die of the flu. Yeah, true. A lot of people who die of the flu are very elderly and you know, have compromised immune systems to start with. Though the idea of vaccinating everyone for the flu when humans for millions of years have been developing, you know, antibodies to to routine flu viruses, it's a lot of money and it's very low yield.
We're talking with Alan Castle about his book. And when we come back, I want to talk about your new book, Seeking Sickness.
Sure.